Well, we left off last week and we kind of noted that the movement that began by bringing people together from a lot of different religious backgrounds had kind of splintered itself. So in the 1915s, shortly after and shortly before World War I, there was a movement to remedy the situation. And I understand why they wanted to do that. That was the same impetus that led to the beginning of the Restoration Movement in the very beginning. So they started to have what have been called unity forums. There was some problem. I don't know why people were upset because they called them unity forums. So they started calling them unity meetings. But it's the same thing. They were trying to find some way to get people back together. So we'll talk a little bit about what was going on. You remember 1906, like we said, there was a major division within the Restoration Movement, and you had the development of really kind of two wings of that movement. The first is called the Disciples of Christ. The second one was the Church of Christ. And when that division happened, the majority of those that had been associated with the Restoration Movement went with the Disciples of Christ. The Church of Christ, on the other hand, was much smaller. It's located mostly in the South. The Disciples of Christ were mostly in the urban North. And the Disciples of Christ had most of the assets. Then there was a movement to try to bring those two groups back together. Now, the major sticking point, the major thing that had caused the breakdown of the unity in the first place was the instrument. There were other associated ideas that caused friction between the two. One was the American Christian Missionary Society and whether or not we would have societies like that. There were not only national societies, there were state societies as well. Well, that effort to create unity pretty well broke down. In the 1914s, Ed Koch, who was the state secretary of the Tennessee Christian Missionary Society, created what was called in 1920 a Commission of Unity. Has really created a deal with the instrumental music question. They distributed a book by O.E. Payne. That book I have not been able to find, but I'm actively searching for that book. I'd like to read it. It not only defended the instruments in worship, but that book and O.E. Payne argued that the Bible actually required the instrument be used in the public worship. One of the commission members, of course, he's from what was the Disciples of Christ movement, wrote a letter that was published in the Gospel Advocate May 18, 1922. And here's just a section of that letter. Calvin essentially talked about why the unity movements were not going to work. He said, we're proceeding on the hypothesis that there can be no unity until our divisive differences are settled. This is important, and settled right. They, and he's referring to the churches of Christ when he said that, will have nothing to do with us, but state openly and flatly that we are a separate people, distinct people. We occupy an irreconcilable position, and there's nothing left for us but fall in or fall out with them. So in terms of assessing why that early unity movement failed, people from the disciples movement basically argued, the Church of Christ said, we'll never get together unless you give up the instrument, unless you give up the missionary society. Well, things didn't improve, but that wasn't the end of trying to bring the disparate groups back together. Now, remember, the groups had originally divided in 1906. The issues were basically the missionary society and the instrumental music. Then those two groups that formed in 1906 themselves split. And we talked about this last week. The disciples of Christ divided into the Christian Church or the Disciples of Christ and the unaffiliated Christian Church, which they called the Church of Christ. Another situation where the Christian Church was the mainstream group that came out of that division. They had most of the assets, most of the membership. The Church of Christ divided. This time it had to do with the instrument and the institution, and the support of institutions and the support of missionary societies. When the Church of Christ split, it split pretty much along the same lines that we keep seeing. The majority group, the mainstream group, kept 80% of the members and about 80% of the assets. The Church of Christ that came out of this was pejoratively called antis because they were anti-society. They were anti-college. The churches that were, the colleges that were supported out of the funds that were contributed by churches. They just were felt to be antis. The unity efforts kept going. This time it was between the mainstream Church of Christ and the disciples of Christ, the mainstream disciples of Christ. The Church of Christ over here, where most of us find our heritage, this group is pretty much left out of the discussion. And they complained, we weren't included in the discussions. How can you have unity if you're leaving out part of the people that ought to be in the unity meetings? Well, these meetings in the 1930s were organized by two guys. The first was Claude Whitty. He was a preacher at the Westside Central Church of Christ in Detroit, Michigan. And James DeForest Murch, he comes out of the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ. he was a preacher and he was an editor. I don't know exactly where he preached, but he was more well known as an editor. And they started a series of meetings. First one is held in Cincinnati, Ohio in 1937. There were 50 men that were chosen from each group, and they came up with a 5-point, what they called, approach to unity. And this is what they advocated as a way to deal with the division that was existing at that time. First, they suggested that we have individual and corporate or congregational prayers for unity. Second, that we ought to survey the membership to determine common points of faith and practice. Not to determine the things that were dividing us, but to determine the common points. Third, they suggested the establishment of friendly relations through what they called fraternal courtesies. And that was basically, if you met somebody on the street, you would say Brother Murch or Brother Witty. And those fraternal addresses, brother, sister, those became really, really important at this particular time, because many times when you met somebody from the other group on the street, you would refuse to call them Brother Murch or Brother Witty, depending on whether that person was aligned with the group that you were aligned with. And they also, in that same point, suggested that there be fellowship meetings. Then, number four, they suggested the establishment of cooperation in what they termed enterprises which do not do violence to personal or group convictions. So where we could cooperate without either group feeling like they had been forced to abandon their belief, there was going to be cooperation. And then, remember, back to the surveys that they were doing, surveys to look for common points. Then they wanted to build study groups and have discussion of the causes of the division. And the causes are becoming more numerous. Around that time, the causes were really the society and instrumental music. Now that's broadened, and it starts to be concerned with institutions like orphans' homes and old folks' homes. And now the institution becomes more and more important. 1938, they held a national unity meeting in Detroit. 1939, they had their second unity meeting in Indiana. Now, I think they called the first one a unity forum, and there was some backlash about calling it a forum. So they decided to call it a unity meeting when it happened in Indiana. After that meeting in 1939, there were a lot of debates that were held about the different issues that were found to be dividing between these two groups. H. Leo Bowles, who comes from the anti-group, who was also at the 1939 meeting, delivered an address that went on for about an hour and a half. I've read the text of the address, and it doesn't say anything that's particularly shocking, but everybody in the anti-group felt like he had done a marvelous job of laying out what the arguments were against instrumental music, the institutions, and those things that were causing division. So that address, somehow somebody got a hold of it, and they turned it into a tract, and that tract was widely distributed among the anti-churches. Now, let's go back. It was distributed over here among the anti-churches, but they weren't the ones who were the real movers and shakers in the unity movement. That was the mainstream Church of Christ that supported the institutions, that supported the societies, and the Christian church, the Disciples of Christ. They supported the institutions, the societies, and they also supported the instrument in worship. So these debates were held, and a lot of people that were watching the debates being held were involved in the debates, but they already had their mind made up. I haven't read of a great many people changing their minds based on those debates. This is what Bowles had to say. And you kind of get a feel for the tone of the discussions. And I can't, you know, this is before things were recorded and they were put on the internet. Now you can watch an address like this on YouTube. Back then you couldn't do it. So you kind of have to get a feel for his tone when he was saying this. You know where you left the Church of Christ. Hence, you know where to find them. Come back. And unity is the inevitable result. Now, he's basically talking about the instrument. There will be no compromise or surrender on the point. The churches of Christ, as long as they are loyal to the New Testament, cannot compromise on this or any other point so clearly taught in the New Testament. You should not want any compromise or error on error. And there will be no compromise. Do you now see the way to unity? And then after a couple of other comments, he said, it is a sin to follow ordinances or services based on the precepts and doctrines, opinions, and teachings of men. And in that category, of course, he puts the instrument, the institutions, and the societies. He says, it is not wrong to bring it, that should be, is it not wrong to bring such things into the worship of God? It is wrong to tolerate them in the worship. It is wrong to affiliate with them or countenance those who bring them in. So even if in Bowles' argument, it's not brought in here, it's wrong for me to have any association with a group where it is brought in. It's sinful to bring anything not commanded by God into the worship of God. So that's Bowles' argument. I find very little that I can argue with in what Bowles had to say, but it does not sound like he was trying to promote unity. It sounds like he's trying to drive a wedge. So We continue through history. Here we are. This is the Restoration Movement, the way it began, divided into the Church of Christ and the Disciples of Christ. Then the Church of Christ divided into the mainstream Church of Christ, which was supporting the institutions, supporting the societies, and the Church of Christ, the antis. Then the mainstream Church of Christ divided by itself. And it divided into the mainstream Church of Christ, which is still the largest group of congregations and individuals that call themselves by the name Church of Christ. And then we saw last week the development of the International Church of Christ, which was the Crossroads Boston movement. That basically came out of the mainstream church. And that's the group that was most affected by it. That's this mainstream Church of Christ is the group that had the most to say about the International Church of Christ. Well, the mainstream Church of Christ and the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, kind of the mainstream of that group, continued the unity discussions. Meanwhile, the antis, and again, that's my heritage. That's probably everybody's or most people's heritage is in the antis. Well, we divided. You had the non-institutional Church of Christ, not supporting the institutions, the colleges, or the orphans' homes, the old folks' homes out of the church treasury. That's really my heritage. Then there was the group that didn't use Bible classes that called themselves the Church of Christ. They're the no-class Church of Christ. Then you had the one-cup Church of Christ, and the one-cup kind of overlapped quite a bit with the no-classes Church of Christ. And then you had another group, even smaller still, the Mutual Edification Church of Christ. No located preachers. If there's going to be any lessons taught, they're going to be taught by individual members. Well, the unity movement continued. But understand, the unity movement didn't have anything to do with this group out here. Nor did it have anything to do with the group over here. Or this group. And the response from the non-institutional Church of Christ was, wait a minute, there's a lot of other things that we ought to discuss. They're still talking about instrumental music. They're not talking about all of the issues that have divided us. And we wanted to talk about the institutions, the orphans' homes, and the old folks' homes, and the colleges that were supported out of the church treasury. Well, this group out here wanted to talk about whether we're going to have one cup or not. But they were really small, and for the most part, they were ignored by everybody else. They were kind of off in a corner, having a tempest in a teapot all by themselves. Now, the non-institutional churches of Christ were a little bit larger, but the mainstream Church of Christ still looked at them as if they were just having a tempest in a teapot all by themselves off over in a corner. Now, this is what's going on in the 1960s. Carl Ketcherside, who was a preacher in St. Louis, Missouri, who had previously been rabidly opposed to anything outside of no located preacher, no using one container to take the Lord's Supper, and no Bible classes, started proposing that we ought to have what he called unity and diversity. Or in some of the things that he wrote, he called it fellowship without endorsement. Leroy Garrett joined him, and it was Leroy Garrett that began to publish the Restoration Review. And I think it was Leroy Garrett that first suggested, and then it was later picked up by Carl Ketcherside, a distinction between the gospel and doctrine. Gospel is what you believed that made you a Christian. The doctrine is what you practiced as a Christian. And their point was, fellowship is based on the gospel. Doctrine doesn't have anything to do with fellowship. So this was picked up, and it became preach the man and not the plan. The doctrine about Jesus. And that was what Carl Ketcherside was suggesting back in the 1960s. But remember, Ketcherside has left the anti-group and he's kind of joined the mainstream group of the Church of Christ. And he's proposing unity with the Christian, with the disciples of Christ. The 1980s. This is at the point where I can speak to some of this from personal experience. This, you know, I was alive in the 1960s, and I did some preaching about what Carl Ketcherside was suggesting. But I really never heard Carl Ketcherside. I was a young man and wasn't all that interested in all of this. But in the 1980s, I was preaching. Reuel Shelley preached a series of sermons on what he called undenominational Christianity. That's the way he titled this series of sermons. He preached this series at the Ashwood Church of Christ in Nashville, Tennessee. They were broadly circulated. Most people that were preachers at the time read with a great deal of interest Reuel Shelley's sermons on undenominational Christianity. And he did really three things in that series that are important as far as these unity meetings and unity efforts are concerned. First thing he did was he talked about Mark, the 9th chapter, verses 38 through 41. This is where the apostles came to Jesus. They said, there's this guy over here. He's casting out demons, but he's not one of us. And Jesus said, you can't be for, you, if you're not against us, you're for us, essentially. That's a paraphrase of Mark 9, 38 through 41. Well, Shelley's argument was that Jesus was willing to endorse the activities of this person that wasn't in Jesus's group. Second point he made, Paul had fellowship with Corinth. And if you've read the First Corinthian letter, that group had more problems than you could shake a stick at. They had messed up the Lord's Supper. They tolerated an adulterer among their group. They were divided. Some people said, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos. just serious problems that were racking this group. But Paul took money from the Corinthian church in order to support his preaching. So not only did he speak with them or speak of them with a certain degree of approval, now he did correct the problems that they had, but he wasn't ready to write them off as not being a church. On top of that, he actually took money from this church in Corinth. And so Shelley suggested that the way to understand all of this was to develop a new hermeneutic. And Shelley had been in the camp with, interestingly enough, with Ketcherside and Garrett, vehemently opposed to these things, to the instrument, to the institutions, to the societies. And by now, the instrument has kind of faded. The societies and the institutions kind of faded a little bit and morphed into what's been called a sponsoring church arrangement. The argument was that if you establish an orphan's home, then the directors of the orphan's home oversee the use of the money that comes from the church. So the church is surrendering its control over the funds that are contributed to the church to care for orphans. And the argument was that the church can't, the eldership can't give up the control of those funds. So instead of giving those funds to the institution, those funds were sent to a sponsoring church that agreed to have the charge of the institution, so that an eldership still had the supervision of that money that had been contributed. Now, it was contributed from people that were outside of the church, but the way that they kind of framed that was similar to what happened in Judea when there was the famine and churches sent funds by the hands of Paul to the elders in Jerusalem, and the elders made distribution as it was necessary. So their argument was that the church in Jerusalem becomes a sponsoring church, and that the money was given to the sponsoring church, and then the sponsoring church took care of meeting the needs that existed. Well, let me talk a little bit about this new hermeneutic that Reubel Shelley suggested. And what he said was, fellowship exists on at least two levels. Relationship between Christians or between individuals exists on at least two levels. Fellowship, capital F fellowship, is something that extends to everyone who has obeyed the gospel. And that would include people in the Christian church, disciples of Christ. But for the most part, they teach baptism for the remission of sins. Then he said, there's a second tier of fellowship, and it's capital F fellowship coupled with little f fellowship. And that is what I enjoy with those who obeyed the gospel. That's capital F fellowship. And little f fellowship refers to the fact that they agree with me on matters of doctrine. Remember back to Ketcherside's distinction between gospel and doctrine. So I have capital F fellowship with people that obeyed the gospel. I have little f fellowship with people that agree with me about supporting institutions, about having a missionary society, about instrumental music. But I can still have capital F fellowship alone with people who disagree with me about practice. And Rubel Shelley termed this a doctrine of limited fellowship. This is what Mike Willis wrote in Truth Magazine. Let's see, this was in October of, I believe it was October. No, I shouldn't say. I can't remember. It's volume 29 of The Guardian of Truth. Or volume, this is what Mike Willis wrote in Truth Magazine, quoting something that had been written in Guardian of Truth. I have been unable to detect, and compare this to the way that Bowles made his statement, and to the way that Cowden made his statement. Now, Bowles comes from my background, my heritage. Cowden comes from the Disciples of Christ heritage. Compare all three of these. Mike Willis is probably from my heritage. He says, I've been able to detect absolutely no movement among the Christian churches, that's the Disciples of Christ, to give up the instrument. Hence, any unity which can be attained and maintained with them must be one that tolerates the use of mechanical instruments of music in worship. This is the disposition that has developed among our liberal brethren and might develop among us. And he stressed this. I think that we are generally agreed that using instrumental musical instruments of music in worship is sinful. However, some have begun to waver in their belief that those who use them in their worship will be eternally lost for using them. Some have said that so long as those who use them are good, honest, and sincere, that they are continually cleansed by the blood of Christ. And that was kind of the latest division, whether we had a continual cleansing or just exactly how to understand the cleansing by the blood of Christ. And they're in fellowship with God. If these brethren can maintain fellowship with God while continuing the practice of their sin, defending it as an act of righteousness, and encouraging others to join with them in the practice of this sin, surely they can also be fellowship with God by God's children. When this kind of tolerance is embraced, we'll be in the same sad condition as our liberal brethren. So the unity movements basically fell apart. Let's go back just a bit. Notice a couple of things. The antis were upset that nobody wanted to debate them. And the people that were encouraging unity said, you're just a fringe group over there. We're not interested in debating the one cup church. So the debates that were taking place in the 1980s tended to revolve around whether we should use multiple cups in serving the Lord's Supper, tended to revolve around divorce and marriage. Those were issues that were over here. For the most part, they weren't debates that included the mainstream Church of Christ. It was this group. Now, this is where I am. I kind of tried to trace my heritage by looking at these green groups. That's where I am. I have at times worshiped with some people that thought that we should use one container in serving the Lord's Supper. I didn't think that was a matter that should drive a wedge between us. They did. So in order to worship with them, we used one container. Now, they eventually got to the point where they said, well, I think maybe you're right, and it doesn't make a lot of difference. I have worshiped with people who did not want to divide the church. Once the church came together, it did not divide up into classes. Whether we're talking classes by age or by gender or by interest. The church comes together, it doesn't divide into classes. And for a time, we came together and we had classes, or we had worship that included everyone. We did not have Bible classes. But those were all discussions that were taking place within the anti-group. Okay. You got everything I know. Comments, questions. Thank you for being so patient. Let me kind of set the stage for our comments.
It seems like they never really came to a conclusion, and it's kind of like people who are arguing something, they just cannot agree, and they agree to disagree. But it seems to me there should be a solution, and I'm like you, but I haven't worshiped with other congregations that are, quote, different than what we do today. So it's more confusing than I realized. It's very complex. I didn't even think about it that way.
They are complex issues. And I don't mean to, I know that by diagramming this, I kind of reduce it to something that looks a lot more simple than it really is.
Yeah, I think it's very complicated.
It is.
I didn't know there was that much confusion in the congregations and things, because I guess I just always went to the one that we practice today. Of course, I was born in 1939, so a lot of things, but we didn't know or even consider, because by the time I became a Christian, it was practiced the same way it is today, with no music. And a cup that we can drink from separately, and song books, and we all sang the same thing and did the same thing. And we didn't have, I guess we were called antis. I do remember kind of that, because we're anti everything but what we think. So
that's true.
So
that's true.
Yeah, that's true. But it also should be noted, Dean, that we have worshiped with congregations that are more mainstream.
That's true.
Yeah. And so.
That's true.
Yeah. In our experience, our background is more along the lines of what would be pejoratively called the antis, but we have worshiped with groups that are more mainstream.
That's true. That's true.
Well, that's still confusing because of the mainstream. I think they're more liberal. I think, to myself anyway.
I worshipped with a group that had it's very much like what we are, which I consider myself still part of you. But anyway, we had a kitchen, but it was never ever, they would have potlucks right there at the building, and they weren't potlucks away from the building, but they were never ever brought into the service at all. It wasn't part of the service. It was always either after the service or on a different day, you know, potlucks and what have you. And there's a lot of people that absolutely refuse to go somewhere where that there is a kitchen. And that, would you call that, Dean, kind of the mainstream?
Yeah, the mainstream would typically not have any problem with having a kitchen.
Yeah, that was our experience as well. They did not have instrumental music, but yes, they did have a kitchen and what they called a fellowship hall.
A fellowship hall, yes.
Yeah, a place where they would eat together and that kind of thing. And that was not an issue for them at all.
But I also went to a Church of Christ down in Texas once upon a time where that they had the kitchen. But then they were allowing people to go get up in the middle of the service and go get them a cup of coffee and bring it in, or get up in the middle of the service and go get, you know, snacks, and the kids could go get snacks and that sort of thing. And I didn't agree with that part. I thought
that's disruptive, and there's not, it tends to create more problems, I think, because you're too busy getting your coffee to drink instead of listening to the sermon and paying attention to what's going on. It's like you're not with a special devotion to God. You're kind of like you're at home. You're listening to it over the radio or something. To me, if you have people who are coming from all distances and coming to the building, and you do have a kitchen, maybe there is a purpose for that, because you could have, they have to go back home and come back. It's too hard for them. So maybe, I don't.
Well, I think that this was probably how it, many, many years ago, people drove miles and miles and miles to go to church, or in a buggy and wagon, they might ride miles and miles. And they had after services, they had a meal. So, I mean, yeah. That's...
Yeah, they usually called it dinner on the ground.
Yes.
That's true. I've heard of that, and I could understand that at some period of time. We don't have any problem with that, I don't think, today. But I suppose there would be a time for that, for sure, because we went to one place, and they were all outside, and... where we were, there was a little kid that ate dirt. I never will forget that, but it was on the ground, and they had, you know, they just had their meal there in between the services.
So, oh, my mother always told about a time when she was a child in Arkansas, and you all know Claude and Clara Parsons, her parents. They would walk to church for a long, long distance. And they would worship together, and everybody brought their lunches because it was such a long distance. And they would eat on the grounds. They would eat there at the church building, and then they would meet together for a small little class afterwards, but they would dismiss before it got dark so everybody could walk back home. So it was very poor, very rural, but it was not a big deal to eat at the church building. That was not an issue at all. It was to facilitate them being together.
Exactly. And I have known people that were very irate if they came into the building and there was a, you know, they would turn around and leave. If there was and Dick and I one time went to a Church of Christ, walked in and had no idea that they had an instrument at all. And we were sitting there and, you know, talked to people, and all of a sudden a piano started, and people started singing with the piano. A song leader get up, but they started with the piano. And now that, we took communion and left, you know, so, but they did the communion the very after. Yep. We should have gone in prior to and made sure, I guess, asked.
Well, you communed with them. I think they were brethren. They had a different understanding.
Yes. But they believed, you know, they were probably have been called the disciples of Christ. I don't, although it said on the building, it said Church of Christ.
Yeah. They were probably more aligned with the disciples of Christ. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in any case, they all are our brethren, and we should love them as our brethren. I get that.
Agreed. Absolutely.
We're all baptized into the body, and they think they're right, and you think you're right, and I think I'm right. We shouldn't have any bitterness to them, but I still feel uncomfortable sometimes with the kitchen. But we eat in our church building too when we're cleaning the building and thing, and there are no services.
Mm-hmm.
We don't eat in the kitchen, but we don't have one.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other people who have storages of food so they can hand it out. There's a whole lot of things that are little things, and should we really condemn them for that? I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I'm kind of just one line. I like the way that we have done for so many years, and anything that's different feels weird, honestly, to me. But it doesn't mean that they're right or wrong. I can't condemn them. It's not my job, and it's not my job to judge them either. But I'm supposed to be in harmony with them as much as I can.
I respect that, Jimmy. It's not part of our experience, but that doesn't mean it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of not part of our experience.
Exactly.
Well, it feels wrong when you haven't practiced it for so long. And my son was telling me about a place that he worshipped recently, and everything was going fine, but the women took up the collection. And I thought about that for a long time. I've never seen that or heard of it. But if you're called a deacon, it means a helper. And if the elder said they could, I'm not sure that's wrong, but I would never participate in it. I don't think it. I think the men are, I think you're usurping men's authority. But if the elder said that, who knows? It just is different. It's very different. And Phoebe was a deaconess. And all she did was take a letter to somebody, so I get it, but that's the other thing. I don't know if I could even stay the whole service. But the men were in charge of the table, and I don't know who served the Lord's Supper. I guess the men did. It was just interesting. There are a whole lot of interesting things that are very odd over the period of time.
That's true.
But they're still our brothers, because they're baptized into Christ's body the same as we were. I don't know. We just have to.
In all honesty, Cecil Willis would say you're wrong.
Me?
Yeah, he would say that's a wrong-headed statement.
Well, who is he and what power does he have?
He comes out of the non-institutional background, same as I do.
Uh-huh.
And he, you know, he would argue that you're countenancing sin. If you countenance this, it's a sin to follow ordinances. This is what Aislinn O'Boole said, it's a sin to follow ordinances or services based on the precepts, doctrines, opinions, and teachings of men. It's wrong to bring them into the worship of God. It's wrong to tolerate them in worship. And here's the important thing he said. It's wrong to affiliate with them or countenance those who do bring them in. And his discussion was basically came out of 3 John.
Dean?
Yeah.
Well, we offered strange incense. So this is where people get such... get so dogmatic about every particular opinion that they hold. But unless it's a thus saith the Lord, if it's a possible gray area, then you should be willing to study it with them, or you can necessarily tolerate it. It's like you were studying, reading scripture and talking about the Lord's Supper, and then it says, and then they supped. So, I mean, and I had never paid any attention to that. So maybe you don't want to commend the money that you gather for something like a fellowship room so that you can have a communion. But Lee was going to say she was over in Missoula, Montana, and they came from a long distance. After they had services, they had lunch, in a fellowship hall or outside. And then they went home because it was too long a trip for them to be able to go home. And if it's for the betterment of worship, then I can sort of understand having a kitchen for that. But then when you just starting to decide to have a kitchen and then, you know, you're going to have a spaghetti feed to make money and this and that, then, you know, you can start going down rabbit holes. So you have to look at each individual situation and decide whether you can worship with that. You could at least maybe visit with them sort of thing and take communion. But if you're there and that's the soundest church you have, and before Zoom you couldn't do anything, I mean, it might be the best you can do.
I don't know, but I don't feel very liberal. It bothers me, but if I don't know. It makes me feel uncomfortable. All of those situations do. So I would choose not to worship. But I don't know if I would condemn them or not, because it's not my job. But I don't know. I'm very confused about the whole thing when you come right down to it, because I am anti. That's what I am, I guess, because I don't argue with them. We do sit down and we do study the scriptures if I have opportunity. And Kenneth said, well, that's just because you're not familiar with it, and so you can't accept it. It isn't that, I don't know. I just think that's very liberal, and I couldn't worship there.
Well, let's go back to the fact that we had an elder who believed that, had an eldership that one of them believed that you couldn't have divorced people in the congregation. But so long as we didn't force him to not believe in that, for a long time he could believe in that. But now, then he had to resign because his friends from down south had the other point of view and were anti-us sort of thing. So I think you have to look at love and what you do with love.
Well, there is a scripture that says that they were not doing the right thing, but they were preaching Christ, and he told them, leave them alone.
So it's Mark 9.
Yeah. So that has to come in too, I'm sure.
Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate the comments and the thoughts, and the more we understand, the better we do. I'm not sure I know all of the answers. In fact, I'm pretty sure that I don't know all of the answers. I'm just trying to tell you what went on in history.